From India's largest newsroom, I'm Arun George, and this is the Times of India podcast. If one considers that the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are based on real events, then when did the events cited in these epics take place? Mythologist and author Devdutt Patnaik recently shared a post on social media in which he went by calculations that are popular on social media and tried to put these in terms of archaeological discoveries and history. According to his post, these epics would have taken place before the Harappan civilization, before the Vedas were written, and even before horses came to India. Given he's a regular on this show, my colleague Jairaj Singh and I asked him about this strange timeline that he shared.
Devdutt, you recently put up this timeline of mythology and human history as we know it, and you put the Mahabharata before the arrival of horses in India. Now, that's pretty problematic for a generation like ours because we grew up watching the televised version of Mahabharata where everyone has horses. So, why would you do that? Why would you change that sort of perception of ours of it?
This idea that Mahabharata has occurred around 3000 BC and Ramayana has occurred around 5000 BC is a faith-based understanding that is extremely popular in India, and it is based on some astronomical data that has been found in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. It is not a peer-approved date. No peer review has happened. It is not published in any international journal. It's a popular amongst people who believe and who want to see the Ramayana and Mahabharata as historical events. It's called euhemerism. This euhemerism is a school of thought which assumes that mythological stories, sacred stories of a culture really come to us from historical characters who have been deified. It's a Greek idea and it's an ancient idea that all gods are actually humans, and this is a 19th century idea. It didn't exist. To be honest, this kind of idea has been there in history and it's very popular in certain political circles. They have come up with this date. I haven't come up with this date. The purpose of putting this in context is to tell people that if you accept this date blindly, without peer review, and I'd respect it. But if I put it with peer-reviewed understanding of Indian history, it just tells me these things happened before the arrival of horses, because genetic evidence shows that the domestic horse that we know today was domesticated in Russia around 2000 BC. So roughly at the time when the Harappa civilization came to an end. So when Harappa civilization was coming to an end, horses were reaching their final stage of domestication. Shortly after that, they invented the chariot. And shortly after that, horse-drawn chariots were seen in battlefields of Egypt and Near East, that is around 1500 BC. So that is a peer-reviewed archaeological text data, which is there. But then there is this faith-based understanding. And if I put the two of them together, they look strange. And I think I put it together because I want to tell people that, you know, we have a right to our faith, but we cannot confuse faith with fact.
In today's episode, Jairaj Singh and I are in conversation with Devdutt Patnaik about what happens when we try to place mythology in history and in historical timelines. Devdutt talks about why it's a problem to try and do this, and also how we limit the concept of divinity when we try to impose scientific limits to it. He also talks about why using a linear timeline to plot these epics may be a very flawed approach. We started by asking him about why he would set the Ramayana and the Mahabharata before the Harappan civilization on a timeline.
Like you said, you know, you put the Ramayana before Ramayana and Mahabharata, also before the Indus Valley civilization, which we know was, I mean, more primitive in the sense of what we know to have happened in the Ramayana and Mahabharata. Okay, if we disregard the astronomy bits, so wouldn't they be located somewhere in the post-Harappan period?
Well, not according to believers. As you can see nowadays, there is a whole archaeological evidence which apparently proves that Harappa is from 8000 BC. So that is even before the Ramayana, which is 5000 BC. So you have these dates floating around suddenly in WhatsApp groups, in a large section of the social media, none of which is peer-reviewed. None of it, whether it is any of the archaeological evidence, which is emerging only in the Haryana region. You know, and so somehow Haryana is the center, because we know that Haryana is where Kurukshetra is located. And so somehow these ideas are, the dates are matching the political discourse, which is fine. And I'm sure it's true, but only when it is peer-reviewed. No scientific data is accepted without peer review. So peer-reviewed papers say the mature phase of Harappa is 2500 BC to 1900 BC, 600-700 years. But everything which we hear from astronomy is before that period. There are mythofiction writers who have written these grand narratives of grand things that happened in India. And this is not unique to India, by the way. It's there around the world. You find people from around the world creating these kind of fantastic mythological narratives which become historical and which defy all things that historians say. You know, for example, in the 19th century, there were these Christian scholars who, based on the Old Testaments, calculated that the world was created, Earth was created in 4004 BC. And then, of course, they discovered dinosaurs. And then everything changed. In India today, the same thing happens. You know, if you challenge it, and they don't want to challenge it, you can get into trouble because you're seen as anti-national, anti-Hindu. So you think, like, you know, if people want to believe, they can believe whatever they want to believe. But if you put fact-based information with faith-based information next to each other, you do find something very funny appearing. And it's funny for those who care. For many people, it is just true. They genuinely believe the Ice Age was Pralaya, and they believe that all civilization emerged in India. Horses were domesticated in India. And from India, the horses and chariots went to around the world. All civilization came from India. There are people in China who believe the same thing about Chinese civilization, that everything came from China. There are people in Europe who believe everything came from Europe. So these are different schools of thought. As I said, I have just put the peer-reviewed data that I have. And if somebody wants to change those dates, great. I would love a peer-reviewed paper which changes it. I just got this from a friend of mine and I said, hey, it'll be interesting to just put this dates next to it. And then you suddenly find something very interesting.
Devdutt, when you shared the tweet, you also spoke about this great insecurity and yearning of society. What is this insecurity that Hindus today are facing when it comes to recognizing their culture, mythology, texts, and themselves?
So all religions are insecure in the presence of science, because science sort of functions very differently. Now even science is insecure because they are now being threatened by religious folks. So insecurity is a global phenomenon. Hindus believe, and a section of Hindus, not all Hindus, but a section believe that they have been denied their place in the world history, and that Indian civilization has not been given its due, as we were subjects of a colonial power. And they are demanding that space. They're demanding respect. They're demanding attention. It's a demand that perhaps is valid, and they are going about it by creating these narratives. And that's all it is. It's just this, we deserve a place, because everything seems to be coming from the West. All technology is coming from the West. And the argument is, how can everything come from the West? Indians were great too. So it feels that India didn't invent anything. And that upsets a lot of people, because what they don't realize is that it's migratory. These ideas are spreading in all different directions. So they get triggered by any suggestion that anything came from outside. Everything comes from inside. And that's a mindset which is very, very prevalent. A civilization, by definition, is one that exchanges. It's not the one that gives. It's also the one that receives. That's a definition of, archaeological definition of civilization is when you find exchange of goods between cultures. A culture is just a man-made phenomena. A culture becomes a civilization, as per archaeologists, only when there are evidence of exchange and trade. You don't use the word civilization in archaeology unless you see signs of trade. Older definition of civilization was large-scale monuments indicating hierarchy. But that is an old definition, which is a very colonial definition. But when people today are using about Hindu civilization, they're really talking in terms of grandeur. We are the big guys. We are equal, or if not better. That's coming from a chauvinistic place, which is, I guess, some people need it. And those who need it, I define such people as insecure. The yearning for a place of power.
That's interesting. When you contextualize Hindu civilization with the concept of India, because both are not mutually exclusive, can you give us a sense of when the Hindu civilization comes in its own? Because we know that the idea of nationhood is very, very recent. Where do these two, sort of meet?
I'll give you an example. Is Greek civilization European? If I ask you this question, it's not, because when Greek civilization exists, there was no Europe. There was Mediterranean. Right. Europe as an idea emerges after the rise of Islam. Islam takes the lower part of Mediterranean, the northern part of the Mediterranean becomes Europe. But if you ask a European, he will say Greek is European. He doesn't say Greek is Mediterranean. When you ask a European, is Christian a European idea? He will say it's European, but it's not. It's a Middle Eastern idea. But for him, Middle Eastern is Islam. So these kind of is a very postmodern scholarship that is used. You know, invention of words, checking out words. It's a very late 20th century scholarship that looks at words and says, well, this idea didn't exist at that time. Nation didn't exist at that time. When I use these words, I use them very casually. When I use the word Hindu, I'm using really in as a mythologist, the land where rebirth as an idea emerged, which is unique to India. As a conceptual framework, rebirth is unique to South Asia. So I stay away from these conversations. Is it Hindu? Is it Indian? For me, the definition of Indian is rebirth ideas. For me, the definition of West is one life ideas, where values placed and where judgment day is very important. And for me, when I use China, I usually refer to those which believe in ancestral. So there are very specific definitions. These can be challenged all the time. So one has to use them as placeholders and not take them so seriously that it leads to violent debates.
Some faiths have certain advantages. Like Islam is more recent in the sort of faith sense. So therefore, you have historical markers. But then even with something like Christianity, you have something like the Shroud of Turin, which a lot of people believe in and yet has no basis. We don't know if it's a historically accurate thing. So what are the challenges when you start trying to locate faith in history?
If you ask a Muslim, when did Islam begin? He will say from the beginning of time. He will not say 1400 years ago, 7th century, because that's a historian's way of looking at Islam. For a devout Muslim, when the world began, Allah created the world and Islam began on that day. And then 1,24,000 prophets came with 1,24,000 ideas. And some of them had new messages, some had reinforced messages. So you have this difference between the messenger who reinforces and the messenger who brings a new idea. And there are only five who bring new ideas. So there's a whole Islamic mythology. And which, of course, Hindutva doesn't know that there's something called Islamic mythology. Everybody has their own mythologies. And this mythology tells you that there were many, many prophets. So Jesus is a prophet in that world. Moses, some would argue David, even Solomon. These are various prophets who came up with messages. The final one being the prophet Muhammad 1400 years ago. So see how it is. The narration is very different from what a historian will see. The historian will argue things, questions like, when was the Quran written? And a Muslim will say, no, it is not written. It is to be recited. It has come from God via the angel. But as far as a historian is concerned, they'll say, it's a document. Who wrote the document? Where was this first put together? Let's figure it out. We know that when the caliphs tried to formalize the book, many versions were burnt and destroyed. How much of it is human? How much it is divine? Because if it's a divine document, it stops being historical, right? It's the moment you say it's God has composed it, then it's not historical anymore because God is not a historical idea. Same thing applies to Christianity. While the mythology talks about history as part of their mythology, God created the world and we are living this story which will end with the apocalypse. And there is a beginning, the first chapter, and there's a last chapter, and it's a very clear, linear narrative. The idea of the mythology of Christianity is very different. So you have to talk about God, again, not a historical character, and therefore Genesis. And, you know, there's something very interesting, I'll tell you. Middle of the 4th century, the Roman Empire became Christian, which means the Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity. And the reason we know is because he wanted to protect his fragile, his empire was breaking down and therefore he needed something to bind it and he chose Christianity. Why did he choose Christianity? Because his mother, Helena, was Christian. And we are told that she travels to Jerusalem and finds bits of the cross. And suddenly, just as, you know, Christianity is emerging, the cross is found. Bethlehem is discovered. All the spots where Christ goes, they figure out exactly where the passion took place. So suddenly this discovery takes place, very much like we are now discovering holy cities of India, discovering dates of India, discovering palaces, discovering chariots. It all happens with the political movement. So there is this kind of a politics, history and mythology sort of coming together. Saint Helena, she's called a saint and finds so many bits of the cross that as per one scholar, if you put all those bits together, the cross would be 200 feet high. Because you know, everybody would have said, this is Jesus' cross, this is Jesus' cross, this is Jesus' cross. Typically, as it happens in holy lands, and if you collect all of them and put them together, somehow something doesn't make sense. But that's everywhere. So it's seen in the Roman Empire, you see it in Islam. You know, the Shias will not agree with the history of the Sunnis. So there are different histories within the so-called historical framework. And a history which includes God and word, like the word prophet is not historical. The word God is not historical. It is no longer a historical term because it assumes the existence of God. Same thing if you use the word Christ, anointed one. Anointed by whom? Anointed by God. Again, God is not a historical term. But since the European universities refuse to look at Christianity specifically, not Islam so much, but Christianity in the way they looked at Hinduism, there was a kind of an asymmetry in scholarship. Even today, the word theology is used for Christianity, not mythology. But mythology of monotheists is theology. I mean, since I'm a mythologist, I can say it, but that's a very new idea. These are very, very new ideas. 100 years ago, I would have been challenged and there would be theology would be a subject. For me, theology is just another form of mythology.
Also, something you pointed out was the fact that the time itself within our faiths isn't as linear as it is in history, right? Most holy books don't seem to list the exact date on which something took place.
You know, the word Jerusalem. Jerusalem appears in history only around the 6th and 7th century BC. Right, and the story of Moses, Exodus, etc. start appearing only around 5th, 6th century again because that's the time when the exile of Babylon took place and the people from Israel were taken by the Assyrians to Babylon. And so really these stories, but they talk about an ancient time, they talk about an older time. And then in the 19th century when people started dating, they said, oh, this happened in 1500 BC. And the Exodus happened in 1500 BC. Now, historian will, and Israeli historians, so it's not like Israeli historians living in Israel, and in peer-reviewed journals have argued that there is no record of Exodus in the Egyptian hieroglyphics. So it's just a made-up story, but it is a story that binds a people. And because it binds a people, it's considered to be mythological. That's the definition of mythology, a story that binds people. Now look at an Indian story. When the Ramayana and Mahabharata was put down in writing, the Brahmins were dealing with a new world order. The old Vedic world had come to an end. Buddhism had come. Jainism had come. New kings had come, like from Northwest. Nobody remember. They all talk about Muslims entering India from Northwest. Nobody remembers the Scythians, the Parthians, the Kushans, who came from Central Asia, who controlled all the trade routes, who favored the Buddhists and did not care too much about Brahminical rites, which were very secretive. And then the Brahmins change and reimagine Hinduism. And that's a huge change that happens. And it's sort of legitimized by 300 AD, 400 AD, when the Guptas come to power. Now, when they are writing their books, for the first time, we see this concept of Chatur Yugas, four Yugas. So the Yuga concept is not there in Vedic scriptures. It is there in much later scriptures from 400 AD. And suddenly you have these Chatur Yuga, four Yugas appear. And this whole idea of there was a perfect time called Krita Yuga. Then there is Treta Yuga when Ram is born. Then there is Dwapara Yuga when Krishna is born. And his death marks the beginning of Kali Yuga. And this idea emerges. And we find Pulakeshin too in 800 AD saying that, you know, my defeat happened so many years after the death of Krishna and the Mahabharata war. So by then, they already are seeing this as a historical event in their imagination. They don't have the privilege that you and I have. And they're looking at that. And you see this idea of Chatur Yuga and giving it a time. Aryabhatta uses it to define the four yugas. Manusmriti starts using it. These are new ideas. These ideas didn't exist in the Rigveda, Samaveda, Atharvaveda. These are not there. In the oldest Ramayana scripture, Sita makes a comment to Ram where he says that I want to go to the forest. You stay in the palace. And she keeps arguing her case and he says, no, you stay, stay, stay. And she finally wins the argument by saying, whenever the Ramayana has been written, I follow Ram to the forest, so you have to do it. So she, in this old version, there is a sense of a repetitive story called the Ramayana, right? That means time is cyclical. It is happening round and round and round. And by those logic, Ramayana happened several 100,000 years ago. If you read Jain scriptures, in the Jain scriptures, there are 24 Tirthankars. There is Mahavir. Before him, there's Parshnath. And before that, there's Neminath, who is contemporary of Krishna. And before that, there is Muni Suvrata, who is a contemporary of Ram. And their dates, if you match in the Jain scriptures, is over 180,000 years old. So, 180,000, we're not even talking about 8,000 BC, we're talking about 180,000 years ago. Now, how do you make sense of it? Because these are coming from religious texts. What do they mean when they're saying 180,000 years ago? Or somebody's age is 10 raised to the power of 224. These are these giant numbers because they spiral with time. With each earlier age, men are taller, live longer, and the periods of time expand. Now, do I take it literally? Do I take it metaphorically? Why should a Jain idea be considered different from a Hindu idea? Why should, again, India be seen as Hindu and not Jain? And then, you know, people talk about historical Buddha, but historical Buddha is only because British gave it value so much. As far as the Buddhists were concerned, he was one of many Buddhas. There are Buddhas before him, after him, simultaneously. There are Buddhas of Pure Land, Sukhavati. There are Amitabha Buddha. There are different Buddhas out there. So this whole idea of a historical Buddha that we have privileged is a 19th century colonial construct. No Buddhist saw it like that. It's a very new idea. This, you know, that he lived 2,500 years ago. There was a historical moment. So the point is that Indians saw time as a cycle or as a spiral. The Middle Eastern saw it as a linear moving towards a climax. There's no apocalypse. There's no judgment day in Hinduism. So time has a very different meaning. Then God can be present in different times simultaneously. You can travel to different realms and time changes. There are kings who go to Brahma's world for one day and return to find 1,000 years have passed. So time has a very different meaning in Indian thought. But now you have imposed this timeline of 8,000 BC because you want to be scientific, you want to be historical, ironically claiming that you're decolonizing yourself by aligning with the colonial framework.
What do we lose when we sort of hardcode these concepts of very hardcore science things into faith? What do we lose in our faith because we want science in there?
Science is material. Science is very bad in psychological things. It's terrible. It works very, very badly when it comes to a non-material, non-measurable, non-manipulatable, you know, thing. Because science is all about things, not about thoughts, right? But mythology is all about thoughts and not about things. So they're very different from each other, right? You have to separate the two. Now, suddenly you've privileged science and everything has to be scientific and everything has to be within this material framework. Now, that creates a problem. Now, I always tell people about the gospel and I talk about the New Testament. You have Christ dying and then he resurrects himself after 3 days as a spirit and tells people, spread my word everywhere. Now, this universalizes Jesus. He's no longer restricted to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Israel. Suddenly, Jesus can go anywhere he wants through his people because he's the word. If you look at Buddhism, Buddha does the same thing. He says the idea of the Buddha is important, the Dhamma, the teaching is important, and the organization Sangha is important. So geography is not important. And how do you do that? You take, Ashoka takes 84,000 relics and puts it in different parts of the world and establishes stupas and suddenly universalizes it. He says it doesn't matter where he was born. And an idea can be universal. A physical body cannot. So the moment you turn Ram and Krishna into physical things and historical things, you locate them in North India, in the Gangetic Plain. In a country like India, which is diverse and is federal in structure, you suddenly are telling Tamilians that Ram is not born in Tamil Nadu. Ram is not born in Andhra Pradesh. Ram is not born in Odisha. Ram is not born in Maharashtra. And that's not unacceptable for the Hindu because he says Ram is everywhere. He's in my heart. He's there in my house. He's everywhere in every temple. Now, these are not historical ideas. These are psychological ideas. And this is what people don't understand, that when you go in the science world, you limit things to history and geography. You limit your gods rather than deny them what they are, limitless. This limitless quality, mythology makes it limitless. Mythology makes it timeless. Mythology breaks it from the limitations of space and time. History, science imposes space and time. And that is something that very, you know, these people just, you're missing the point when the, you know, in Sikhism, they'll say God is nirakar, without form. They are akal, without time. So don't historicize him. When moment impose time, then you kill him. Well, not kill him, but you limit and you miss the point. These are limitless ideas. Let's know what is history. Let's know what is geography. Let's know what is faith-based understanding. Let's know what is fact-based understanding. What is timeless and time-bound, and what is limitless and limited. And I think that's what I am interested in. And hence that map to show you what happens when you put gods inside maps and timelines. Somehow they lose divinity.
Today's episode was produced by Jairaj Singh and Sahil Gupta. For a daily spotlight on people, ideas and stories that matter, subscribe to us. We're available on TOI Plus, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts and all other platforms of your choice. For any news tips, email us at toipodcast@timesinternet.in.